ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। ॐ श्रीगुरुभ्यो नमः। ॐ गणेशाय नमः। ॐ श्रीदक्षिणमूर्तये नमः। Let's chant the introductory prayer. Let's chant this together. Om Vasudevendra Yogindram Natva Jnana Pradam Gurum Mumukshunam Hitarthaya Tattvabodhobhidhiyate. So we've been looking at the sadhana-chatushayam, the fourfold qualifications for a student of Vedanta, endowed with which that student will be able to immediately appreciate and see what is being taught. And these qualifications, these attributes, are natural in a relative degree for a jnani, for one who has knowledge, and they are the sadhana for mumukshus. They are disciplines, they are things to pay attention to, attributes to nurture for one who is interested in gaining this knowledge. So we can approach these really as a description of what is for a jnani or what might be for a mumukshu. And we saw the first is viveka, the discriminative discernment between the nitya and anitya, between that which is time-bound and that which is not time-bound. And we saw that in terms of the purushartha vichara, in terms of the analysis of kama, artha, and dharma, and moksha, the four things that we pursue as human beings, and discriminating between what has lasting value and what doesn't have lasting value. And that grows into the second quality, which is vairagya. Vairagya is the objectivity that comes from that viveka. In that context, we talked about a shampoo for a bald man, the attitude that a bald man has vis-a-vis shampoo, or a balloon. When we were 6 years old, we had a much different relationship with a balloon than we do as an adult. And so that basically just is the objectivity, often translated as dispassion, but better translated as objectivity. And then the third quality is actually sixfold. Shamadhi shakti sampatihi. Sampatihi is the wealth or the achievement of the sixfold attributes, shama, etc. And we took Dhamma first. Chakshuradi Bahyendriya Nigraha is Dhamma. And we saw that if you are particularly sensitive to your looks and you have a poor choice of clothing that perhaps one of your parental figures has provided for you, and someone comes up to you and makes that very clear, if you go off and hit them in the face when they come up and remind you that you're ugly and your mother dresses you funny, that is a decided lack of Dhamma. Dhamma is the capacity to have options regarding the bahyendriyas, the dashendriyas. There's five jnanendriyas, five senses for input, speaking as an ex-computer science person, and five capacities for output, five capacities to contribute, the karmendriyani, and five capacities to receive knowledge about the world. So having some choice regarding these is Dhamma. Shama is having some choice regarding what is in the mind. So if I have Shama, I don't really need Dhamma, or in other words, Dhamma comes very naturally because I don't need to control my actions or what I bring in because I have this natural quietude of the mind. So at first it could be seen, you know, the control of the senses and the control of the mind. If you're really in a situation where you need to struggle to not hit that person because they insulted you, that's a very strong act of will. As it becomes easier, it becomes less of a struggle, and then it just becomes natural. So we saw that the shama is mano nigraha. Dhamma was the bahyendriya nigraha, the control or the capacity for options vis-a-vis these. You have in the shama, you have mano nigraha, the capacity for some options regarding the mind. It's not a suppression of thoughts, it's a resolution of thoughts. It's a spaciousness around your thoughts, such that you can see thoughts come and you can see thoughts go. You can let them come and let them go. And it's an alertness, because you have the ability just to let go of thoughts, even though they keep clinging, right? We have some very habitual ways of thinking. And sometimes we see through the truth of those habitual ways of thinking, right? We see the falseness of some of these tapes. Swamiji would always talk about tapes in the 80s. I don't know if he talked about MP3s now, but there are these loops that go on in our brain telling us things about the world and about how we feel, about who people are and who we are. And so if we see those tapes running, the ability to change the topic mentally, to put those aside, to say, oh, that's an old way of thinking. That's not true. Those balloons, you know, oh no, I should be very sad because I no longer have that balloon, right? If you have a great attachment to this helium balloons and it goes away, you can say, oh, that tape that makes me feel so attached to having that balloon, I'm more mature than that. So you can be mature, but the mind takes some time to catch up with these things. The mind can still play these tapes that says, oh, you need to be sad now because you've lost your balloon. So the ability to kind of put those habitual tapes aside or just let them run their course. Some of these tapes are so strong that even when they're bodhita, even when they're sublated, even when you see through them, they still go on. If you sit and watch a sunset and you don't know what's going on and you think that the sun is actually going to sink into the ocean, and then after a while or someone tells you, no, it's not sinking, it's going to come up again, and every day it happens, you may still have fear that the sun is not going to come up tomorrow. But you say, oh, no, don't worry, it's fine. I know that the sun will come up tomorrow. So, but you could still have this residual tape that says, uh-oh, you better worry, the sun may not come up tomorrow. So shama is a way to let the thoughts come and go, and also process those feelings, work with those tapes and especially those bothersome tapes, and to let them go. Uparamaha is an expression of one's focus, particularly regarding mumukshutvam in one's life, a one-pointedness, not being a dilettante in a sense, and limiting distractions. And this expression of focus takes form of swadharma anushtanam eva, the following, the anushtana of one's swadharma, of doing what the universe calls for you to do, doing what a given situation calls for you to do, doing one's dharma, however that's defined, and we went into how that's defined in more detail. And sometimes this uparati or uparama is talked about as sannyasa, because that is a very dedicated lifestyle to the pursuit of this moksha. They're both valid. In the Gita, it talks about two lifestyles, karma yoga, an active, engaged lifestyle, and a renunciate lifestyle for those who have no other obligations or interests. And that is uparama. Tatiksha, shitoshna sukadukadi sahishnutvam. It is a often translated as forbearance. This is the next one, forbearance, endurance. It sounds like a biathlon or triathlon or a marathon, something you have to endure to the very end. But really what it is, it's the capacity to gracefully accept the vicissitudes of life, to see that the world is dvandva, filled with duality, filled with yin and yang, and it's always moving between one and the other. And it's always coming and going. All situations are coming and going in the world, in the jagat. The word itself, jagat, can be seen as meaning jayate gacchati. Jayate gacchati. It comes and it goes, it comes and it goes. And it's inevitable. My horse runs away. It comes back with five other horses. Good news. My son falls off the horse. Bad news. My son's not conscripted into the army. Good news. So these situations, the sukha and dukkha, come and go, and are just our ability to accept those changes relatively with grace. And having the serenity to accept those and having the courage to change the things that we can and the wisdom to know the difference. And this involves holding on lightly to the models that we have about how the world should respond to our actions and what should come our way. We may have our bow in our hand, and we may knock the arrow, and we may pull it, and we may let go, and that arrow might fall straight to the ground. I've had that happen. Or it could hit the target. Or it could overshoot the target. So what's my reaction? What's my reaction when it hits a bullseye? And what's my reaction when it overshoots the target and the arrow gets lost in the bushes behind the target? If I have a model that the results of my actions should always match my expectations, then I'm going to be in for a world of hurt, because there are so many variables that come into play. If I realize that I only have control over a tiny bit of this, I can choose to have the bow and the arrow and knock it, and I can train as much as I can, and I can still let go, and the wind may take it. Or my skill may be very limited. Or who knows, a bird may... Oh, no, I don't want to hit a bird, but so many things can happen. And if I don't hit that target and I get mad, that's one option. If I hit the target and I get elated, that's an option. If I hit the target and I'm pleased, and if I shoot the arrow and the arrow goes over the target and I have to spend the next 10 minutes looking for my arrow lost in the forest back there and I'm laughing, that's perhaps demonstrates some degree of tatiksha. Sometimes the arrow hits the target. Sometimes the arrow completely misses the target. Oh, well, because we have a certain model of, I am going to be unhappy if this arrow does not hit this target. I'm going to be happy if this action in my life does not produce this particular result. And that is not a very mature or intelligent approach to life, because we don't have that much control over things. And we don't have that much control over what comes to us and what goes from us. And we started to talk a little bit about, how do we deal with problematic relationships? How do we deal with people in our life who may be negative, who may go on and on about certain problems in their life? You know, they complain, or they don't have a sunny disposition. They can be a drain on us. They can be angry. They could have all sorts of problems. They could be irresponsible, emotionally immature. We all know these problematic people. And so how do I gain the freedom to allow people to be as they are? We talked about this a bit after the class. And one of the keys to this tatiksha regarding other people is this. I mentioned that Swamiji gives this advice to beginning students and advanced students, to remember to not judge oneself by the obtaining condition of one's mind, and meaning one's emotional life as well. Because we have this tendency to say, see anger, for example, and say, oh, there's angry, I'm angry. And then we either need to justify that anger, or we need to tell ourselves how horrible we are. The internalized parent comes through and says, oh, You're supposed to be a holy person. You're supposed to be a spiritual aspirant. You're supposed to be a good person. Good people don't get angry. Why don't you just shove that anger down and pretend it's not there? Oh, I'm supposed to not be angry. Oh, I feel so bad. Oh, now I am judging myself by the next meta condition of my mind, which is the guilt about being angry. Oh, I'm feeling guilty because I'm angry. Oh, I shouldn't be feeling guilty. I'm supposed to be more enlightened than that. I am somatically in touch with my emotions. So now I end up feeling guilty for feeling guilty about feeling angry. What's an alternative approach to this? It's to welcome it. One approach is to welcome anger. It's not like you invite anger in. And when I mean anger, I mean any sort of any of these emotions, sadness or anger. Because when I welcome them in, when I say, come on, come on, do your best, you're not wallowing and you're not, like I said, sitting down and feeding the fire of these emotions, but you demonstrate abhayam, fearlessness, and ahimsa, compassion, when you bring it, you say, bring it, because you want the heat of this fire. You want to see how this mental, emotional order works. There's an order to everything. There's a physical order, there's a biological order, there's an ethical order, orders regarding ontology and epistemology, and there's an emotional order. Krishna talks about this in the Gita. He says, Sangat sanjayate kamaha, kamat krodho abhijayate. So why do we get angry? Kamat krodha abhijayate. Krodha, anger, is born abhijayate from kama. What does that mean, from desire? How is anger born of desire? Anger is born of frustrated desire. What is that frustrated desire? What is that desire? That desire is, this is how this world should be. That's the Sangha. The Sangha, Sangat Sanjayate Kamaha. From attachment, from Sangha is born Kama, desire. From Kama is born anger. What does this mean? It means that we have a model about how things should be, of how things are. And within that model of how things are, I want that arrow to hit that target. And if it doesn't hit that target, krodha abhijayate kamat, from that frustrated desire, that anger arises. So when we welcome that anger, when we welcome that sadness, we say, ah, let me see how this is born. Why am I angry? What is going on here? Oh, I wanted this. I wanted to hit that target. For some reason, I feel like my okayness is dependent upon me hitting that particular target. Am I okay with overshooting that target? How did I overshoot that target? If I just aim a little, a foot higher, maybe that, or a foot lower, maybe that arrow won't go over the target. Maybe it'll hit the target. Maybe I'll start to learn something. Maybe I'll start to understand what's the source of this anger. What's the kamaha? What's the sangha? What's this worldview that I have where I think that the world needs to give me certain things, and my emotional well-being is dependent on the world giving me these things. And I think that there should be a direct causal relationship between my actions and the acquisition of these happy circumstances. And when it doesn't happen, what do I do? It doesn't have to be that kamat krodho abhijayate. It doesn't have to be that from kamaha, from frustrated desire, comes krodha. This is where titiksha comes in. It says, I can have this desire, and this is karma yoga, I can have this desire to hit the target, and I can laugh with joy when it hits the target, and I can laugh with joy when it misses the target. I'm just doing my best. And the results really are prasadam. The results really, whether I hit the target or whether I miss the target or whether the arrow falls onto my feet, I can only do my best. And I don't judge myself by that condition of my mind. If I judge myself by saying I am angry and I am attached to hitting that target, we become embroiled in that whole melodrama. Advice to not define oneself by the obtaining condition of the mind, offers a lot of freedom. It allows you to be as you are at this moment. And this will deepen once we get into the further into Atmavichara. You get more and more spaciousness around this to be able to do this, to be able to not judge yourself by the obtaining condition of the mind. And you let yourself be as you are, if you understand what I'm saying. You can let these psychological processes come and go, and you don't have to beat yourself up, and you don't have to invoke this parental, the superego, this parent, to condemn yourself for having these inappropriate feelings, quote unquote. And it's only when we can let ourselves be as we are. Now, understand when I say that, to let ourselves be as we are, we still focus and nurture all these attributes that we've been talking about, Shama, Dhamma, Viveka, etc. But in the context of that, in the context of emotional reactions, we can let those be. And by letting those be, I mean, we can see that they have a life of their own and they don't ask our permission. Anger doesn't ask our permission, right? It's not an act of will. If I told you, be angry right now, come on, everybody, get angry. Get angry. You can pretend to be angry. You can kind of try to fake it to make it. You can hit your fists against the wall or stamp your feet or something. But it, you know, it's not an act of will. It comes. It doesn't ask our permission before it comes. If we're alert, we can neutralize it. We can pull the rug out. We can even laugh at it coming with compassion. It's important to include that compassion there. But it doesn't ask our permission. So when we find ourselves in a situation where there's anger present, when there's sadness present, we can learn to have a fearless compassion towards that. And that fearlessness is manifest through that welcoming. We welcome it saying, I'm not afraid of you, anger. Come on, do your best. I'm not afraid of you, sadness. I know you're going to go. And I know that the cause of you, and I know you may just be a tape. And I know, you know, you may have some basis in my childhood, or you may have some basis in this model I have where I need to hit the target every time. So if we can let those reactions come and still love ourselves in the midst of those reactions, have compassion for ourselves, for this hurt little children or whatever is the cause of these emotional reactions, if we can accept that and not judge ourselves by that, then we have the basis for allowing another to be, to allowing the other person their own space to have their own emotional reactivity, to have their own anger, to have their own complaints, their own dissatisfaction, their own quirks, right? Their own emotional life. If we give ourselves that space, that lack of judgment, the not judging myself by the obtaining condition of my mind, only then can I not judge someone else by the obtaining condition of their mind. It's just as false for me to say, you're an angry person. Because really, on one level, they're just this individual, this incarnate jiva, trying to do their best. We may not think they're trying to do their best, but just like we're trying to do our best and we lose our temper and we get angry and we know there's an order behind it. There's a reason behind it. And we as alert sadhakas, mumukshus, are looking into it and trying to resolve that and trying to let it go and trying to have compassion for our own predicament. And we can do that for another. So what this is the ahankara. This is this I thought. I am this, I am this, I am this, I am this. I am sad, I am angry, I am bad, I am good. And there's this idea, I think I made this word up, but there's a tvankara. Tvam means you, aham means I. Ahankara is this identification with everything that is going on with us as an individual. Tvankara is the identifying the other person as everything that's going on in that mental emotional package. And if I'm quick to judge myself based on my emotions and the thoughts, as inappropriate or undesirable as they might be, then I'm quick to judge another person. If I have that accommodation for myself, I have the groundwork laid to be accommodating towards another. And then I can have compassion, because I see, just as I can have compassion for myself, I can have compassion for that other person, because there's reasons why I behave in certain ways. There's reasons why they behave in certain ways. And so that can be the basis for titiksha regarding other people's less than loving and accommodative attitudes towards us, or just towards life. So this can be our sadhana, right? Our spiritual practice. But ultimately, and we'll see this more clearly as the classes go on, the beginning of seeing myself as free is to not judge myself by what's going on in the mind, the obtaining condition of the mind. And what is so beautiful about sitting with a realized person, with a jnani, with one who knows, who has atmajnanam, is that when they look at you, they don't see a problem. You can go to a wise man with all sorts of problems, all sorts of self-image issues, and when he looks into your eyes, he doesn't see that you have a problem. He doesn't pigeonhole you into, oh, you think that you're just this little person with all these little problems. He doesn't see that. Because he knows. It's like the 10th man. It's like the 10th man. It's like this pilgrim who saw the situation and the problems that the 10th man was having, and he just smiled. And he went up to the fellow, and he just sort of laughed and said, you don't have a problem. That's the vision that a wise man has regarding our own little problems that we have. He has the ultimate titiksha, because he actually doesn't need to accommodate us. He sees us with no problems at all. So if I don't pigeonhole myself, I have the wherewithal to not pigeonhole another. And when you see another person, to have titiksha, it's a very interesting practice to remember that time changes every instant. Everything is characterized by time. One key attribute of every experience is that it happens in this moment rather than the next moment or the past moment. Every moment, everything is changing. Every moment we're perceiving changes. Everything is changing at every moment. So, you know, that table at time T1 is not the same table at time T2. It's changed. You never step in the same river twice. And you never meet the same person twice. So if I bring all this baggage of my predefinitions of who a person is, I have this buildup, and this person behaves in a certain way, I become reactive to not just what that person is doing in the moment, I become reactive to the whole history of reactions that I've ever had. And every time that person has done something, it's not this one incident, I'm reacting to dozens of incidences that are very similar to that. But when you have a conversation with one who knows, they don't pigeonhole you. A wise man doesn't pigeonhole you. A wise one, even one without atmajnanam, even one who has a bit of wisdom, even one who has a bit of wisdom can see that if you approach a person with freshness, if you don't pigeonhole that person to see them as being the same person they were yesterday, you create a situation wherein they have an opportunity to not behave in the same way they did before. If you see them as somebody who always behaves in this way, then you, by your very presence in some way, are encouraging that behavior again. If you can see them as someone who's struggling, you see them with compassion, if you can see them fresh every time, then you, by your presence, create a situation wherein they may see the door open, and they may see that they may be able to behave in a different way. It's like the difference between a cat and a chicken. So you know this idea they have about free-range chickens. I don't eat birds. I don't eat bird eggs. Many people do. And they think that a humane way to raise chickens is free-range. And often what free range is, it doesn't mean that they're out in an open field. It means that they still have this huge barn, and there's millions of chickens running around all in a very cramped space, but they have this little door. It's amazing. It's amazing what they can get away with. They have a little door that they open, which would potentially allow the chickens to run outside into a caged area. And the chickens tend not to do that. The chickens tend just to stay in. Even if the door is open, they don't go out there. They're creatures of habit, I guess, and they just don't go out there. And yet they can call these chickens free-range chickens because they have the opportunity to go out this little door and go outside for a while. Compare that to a cat. What if you had a cat in a barn and you opened the door? You think, how long do you think that cat, when it was awake, I know cats spend a lot of time sleeping, how long do you think that cat would stay inside and not go out and explore, right? And we don't know if we're dealing with chicken people or cat people, but you hope that they're more like a cat, that if you can see them with the eyes of at least someone who's semi-wise, if there is such a thing, and not pigeonhole them and see them as someone who has the capacity to change, who's not necessarily bound, defined by previous behavior, and who is really now free of those behaviors, you give them an opportunity, at least potentially, to change that behavior and to change their view of how they see themselves. I'm reminded of some people who work with dying people. When you're dying, you almost fulfill an archetype, right? When you're dying, people have a very hard time seeing past the person who's dying. It's very difficult to not just relate to a dying person. And sometimes that person wants to just be seen as they are. They don't want everybody to be looking at them through the filter of death. They may have some other things to say. If you approach that, potentially, that situation, seeing them beyond that role they're playing, beyond their particular personal predicament, even to the degree of someone who's dying, it could be utterly transformative, especially at the time of dying, because it's such a ripe opportunity for making these transformations and seeing deeper truths in life. So, there are some thoughts more about Tatiksha. Shraddha, let's talk about Shraddha. Shraddha kidrishi, Shraddha kidrishi, Guru Vedanta, Vakyeshu, Vishwasaha, Shraddha, Shraddha. Shraddha is a trust. I've talked about this previously in a sort of a limited capacity to noticing and suspending, putting aside the mental framework through which we filter new ideas so that we have trouble listening to really or hearing really what's being said. We want to take ideas that we're hearing, especially if we're well entrenched in existing spiritual thoughts, philosophies, and we want to hang them on, or we want to hang these ideas on the existing scaffolding, and we're not necessarily really seeing what's being said. Now, this is actually taking that one step further. It's saying having a trust in the Guru Vedanta Vakyeshu, having a Vishwasaha, a faith, but it's better translated as a trust into the Guru Vakyas and the Vedanta Vakyas. This can be taken actually two ways. There's Guru, the teacher. Vedanta means the Upanishad. Vedanta means the teaching itself and the teacher, the guru and the teaching. Vakya means a sentence. So a vishwasaha, a trust in regard to the vakyeshu, in regard to the statements of the Vedanta, the Upanishads, the Shastra, the teaching, and the guru and the teacher. Or it can mean the Guru Upatishta Vedanta. It could be the Vedanta, the teaching, the Shastra as taught by the Guru. So it could mean the words of the Guru and the teacher, or the words of Vedanta as taught by the teacher. So why is this not a faith or a belief? Why is it not a belief? Because it's not a speculative philosophy. This is not an armchair philosophy. There's a value here. There's our own very life and happiness that's at stake. And it's not a belief system. We don't rely, this teaching does not rely on producing miracles, on flying, on any supernatural act. It doesn't rely on seeing auras. There's no mysticism about this. Where does faith come in? Where does belief come in? Well, in the Shastra, in the Vedas, there are things to believe in, like heaven. We don't have any other means of knowledge for heaven except for the scriptures that talk about it, right? We don't know that this Homa will produce this result, which may give us better afterlife. We can believe in it if we want to. Within the context of Sanatana Dharma, if you come up within that tradition, or you end up adopting a faith in these things, then it's a belief, it's a faith, it's an idea pending verification. But this isn't a belief system. Why is it not a belief system? Is because I don't need to believe something about myself. I'm here to see. It's like, does the 10th man need to stop when he believes that this wayfarer can solve his problem? This wayfarer, this fellow says, I can show you the 10th man right now, all right? And the 10th man says, I trust you. I have faith in you. Now, what that does, that allows the 10th man to relax. It allows him some shama. It allows him some uparama. He can kind of stop running around all over, and he can stop and listen to what that person has to say, where that man says tattvamasi. So it benefits him. But that faith, that trust, is not the end all. Why? Because it's not like when he talks to this man and he says, yes, I can show you this 10th man right now. That 10th man exists. The 10th man doesn't run around going, the 10th man exists. The 10th man exists. We can go now. The 10th man exists. I believe that the 10th man exists. He doesn't go and text his guru back at the Gurukulam and say, the 10th man exists. There's nothing to worry about. Let's go on. No, that's not the end game. That's not the end of the story, as they say. That is a provisional bhavana pending the shravanam, mananam, and nididhyasana, pending exposure to the pramana, pending the guru saying, tattvamasi, you are that, and him saying, ah, I see that. I am the 10th man. There is no problem. There really was no problem. And he specifically says, guru vakyeshu. You have shraddha, vishwasaha, in regard to the statements of the teacher. Now, why do we talk about a teacher? A couple of reasons. One is that many things are circumstantial. Many things are, like, for example, look at vishesha dharma. Vishesha dharma is particular dharma to a given time and place. And the teacher may have something to say about that. The dharma of 100 CE in the common era, you know, in a traditional Varnashrama society, that one Swadharma is different than in 2014 living in San Diego. And so the teacher's role is to translate some of this into current circumstances. And that's what I meant by circumstantial. Also, this teacher should be a Shrotriyam and Brahmanishtam. We saw Pariksha Lokan, Karma Chitan, Tyadi. And one should approach a Guru who is a Shrotriya and a Brahmanishta, one who knows this teaching sampradaya, this teaching tradition, and who has that vision himself. So, is the teacher an inspirer? Is the role of the teacher to inspire? To some degree, to a very limited degree. One role of the teacher is to light your hair on fire. And we'll talk about this later on with Mumukshutvam. But the teacher needs to flick that Bic lighter and light your hair on fire to make you see that that unending tambora drone of I want, I want, I want is the basis of all searching and all unhappiness. And that the focus in your life is to put your hair out, right? If your hair is on fire, you will get to that lake. If there's a lake over there, you'll get to that really fast. So that's one role that can be considered inspiration. There's a path out. There is a 10th man. But a role of a teacher is to teach, is not to make one believe. He's not a travel agent. If you are part of a religious tradition wherein the goal of your life is to go to heaven, then your inspirer, your preacher, is akin to a travel agent. He's telling you how to get to a better place, to put it bluntly. And the thing is, in this tradition, it's clearly seen that those afterlife experiences, if you believe in them, and if you go to these heavens or hells, seven up and seven down, they say, they're just temporary. And that's why it's a vacation. You go to the Bahamas, you sit on the beach, you get a tan, and you get headaches, and then you come back to your desk job in your cubicle, to this jiva, this cubicle of this body, to your desk job, your dharma. So let me tell you from personal experience. So, you know, before I met Swamiji, you know, I'd been initiated into meditation 10 years before. I'd been singing bhajans for a few years. I've been going to satsangs. I've been going to Gita study groups. I'd been to India to stay at an ashram for 3 months. I'd studied at a university religious studies in Sanskrit. And I'd read Vivekachudamani and the Upanishads and Gita and all these things. And it was very inspirational. And there was always this, aha, yes, there's something there. Aha, yes, there's something there. Yes, I can see that. I could see that. I could see how that could be possible. Isn't that beautiful? Look at that. I can imagine, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas when I ditched my Sanskrit class, we were supposedly studying the Gaudapada Karika Shankara Bhasha in my third year Sanskrit class at university. And in hindsight, we weren't studying it at all. It was very elementary, but still we were trying to work our way through this grammar of Shankaracharya's commentary. And I skipped my Sanskrit class to go see the Swami. I saw a poster, a little black and white poster on a board that said, Swami Dayananda, come listen to him. And what he did was in a 1 hour talk, he took the topics, one topic that's in the Upanishads and in the Vivekachudamani and in Bhagavad Gita, and he didn't inspire me to believe in it. He didn't say, I need to practice harder and I need to just believe and I need to feel and I need to gain this new experience. He basically said, come here, let me show you this. I mean, he didn't really say, come here, let me show you this, but this, I have something I want to show you. Look at this. And it was as if he just opened his hand and said, look, this is how it is. And my mind went, ah, I'd been reading all of this. I've been inspired by this for a decade. And look at this. He just showed it to me as clearly as if there were an apple on the palm of his hand. He said, look at this apple. It's just like this. You don't have to believe that there's an apple on my hand. Just look at it. And that ability to unfold, it's a certain siddhi. It's a certain power that some people have, really, to clearly communicate. But more so, it's the sampradaya. It's this method to unfold this. And I'll tell you what that unfoldment is later on. There's a cliffhanger there for you. And we'll get into this in a week or two. But I saw very clearly a difference between an inspirer and a teacher. A teacher reveals the facts of what is. An inspirer promises you experiences and encourages you to stay on a given path. And perhaps they both have their role, but a teacher delivers the good because there's no promises. It's just a Vedanta is an exploration of realities of what is. And it happens in the moment. And we'll see in this very next section, he'll say that Atma Satyam. Oh, there's a lot there. So really what the Shraddha is, technically you could call it as a trust in the pramanatvam of this teaching. In other words, that this teaching can show you something about yourself. And it's like any other means of knowledge. It's like your eyes. If I were to put up fingers and say, I'm holding up three fingers right now. I'm only holding up two fingers. But if I say, I'm holding up three fingers right now, you'd say, oh, Daksha is getting a little old. He can't count anymore, or he's blind, or where's your faith? Your faith is in the pramana, the means of knowledge, your pratyaksha, your eye, your chakshuhu, your eye. You have faith in your eye because you know that there's not three. Regardless of what I'm saying, you know that there's not three fingers up here. You know that there's only two fingers up here. Why? Because you have astikya buddhi. You have a shraddha. You have a faith, a trust in your eyes. You don't question your eyes. I mean, you may if you have cataracts or whatever, but primarily you have a trust that your eyes reveal what there is to reveal. So too, that's an attitude to have towards the words of the guru and the words of Vedanta. And there's a relief in that, right? When the 10th man heard, oh, there is a 10th man, what relief he got. He didn't know. He believed. He had the stick-to-itiveness to stay with that man and not run away and to listen to what he had to say. But there was a relief right there. And that's what that shraddha itself can bring. Let's go on. Samadhanam kim, samadhanam kim, chitta eka, agrata, agrata, chitta eka agrata. What this means is there's only one thing in front of you. Ekam means one. Chitta eka agra. Agra means a tip, like a tip of a leaf or something. Something agra in front of you. In front of what? In front of the mind. So in front of the mind, there's only one thing. It's a one-pointedness. Samadhanam comes from the verbal root, the dha. All words in Sanskrit, almost all words in Sanskrit are formed from a verbal root plus suffixes or prefixes. So here, samadhanam comes from the dhatu, the verbal root dha, plus the prefixes sam and a. And it's the same sam-a-dha that we get samadhi from. Samadhi, you just add a different suffix. Samadhanam, you add a different suffix. But they come from the same root and prefix. So it means a placing together. Dha means plus a plus sam means placing together, a collection, as in collecting the mind, as in focusing the mind, putting it together, an absorption. And we all have this capacity to be absorbed in something, something that we love usually. To be absorbed in a movie, we'll lose ourselves in a movie, or we're studying something we love, like Sanskrit. And we get lost in it. An hour can go by. If you love Sanskrit, the whole day can go by and you go, oh my goodness, I sat down to study it and now it's time for dinner. And we can build this capacity too, but we all have this natural capacity. And technically it is vijatiya vritti rahita sajatiya vritti pravaha. Pravaha is a flow of what? A flow of chitta vrittis, a flow of thoughts that are sajatiya, are related, are all flowing in the same direction. So like in today's meditation, it was the flow of thoughts to the mantra, to the japa that was going on, and to the silence. So that is sajatiya. It's not one thought. You had a thought of silence, you had the thought of om, and then ishaya, and then namaha, and then silence. Those are all different thoughts. But there's a pravaha, there's a flow of the vrittis in the same direction without distraction, without the vijatiya. Vijatiya means vrittis or thoughts that are unrelated or distractions. Without any distractions, you have a flow of your mind in one given direction. Krishna says, yato yato nishcharati manaha tatastato niyamya etat. He says, wherever the mind wanders, you just bring it back. Wherever the mind wanders, you bring it back. And so if it's a will-based, if you don't have samadhanam, you have to be alert and see that the mind tends to wander and bring it back. And they say that you can become established in this, in japa. So what I introduced today in meditation is japa. Many of you might be familiar with it. We can talk more about it at another time. But if you can keep your mind flowing in that direction for 44 minutes, I think it was 44 minutes, you've gained a certain siddhi, you've become established in that japa, meaning that you can make your mind flow in that same direction. And it can be towards anything. this flow, the samadhanam. For example, Swamiji talks about puja. If you do puja and your mind is focused on doing the puja, there's all these preliminary steps. There's the 16 steps of puja, asanam and padyam samarpayami, arghyam samarpayami, achamaniyam samarpayami. And they're all different things, right? You're doing different things with your body. You're offering water. You're offering food. You're offering camphor. You're offering incense and flowers and the names and everything. But if your mind is focused on that, that's a chitta vritti pravaha. That's a sajatiya pravaha, where your mind flows in the same direction. And you become absorbed in that practice. And you can take that mind, which has the capacity, and focus it on yourself. And that's what eventually what will happen in Nididhyasana. You have the capacity to absorb your mind in just the sensation at the tip of your nose, the sensation of the breath at the tip of your nose. And then you use that to have the capacity to do japa. And then eventually you'll have the capacity to absorb your mind in the silence that is between the japa, the chants. And then you'll be able to absorb your mind, refocus it on the perceiver of both the silence and the japa. So this samadhanam goes quite a long way, especially in the Nididhyasana and the study. Sometimes this is translated as just a stick-to-itiveness. So the capacity to be absorbed in the moment, in a meditative moment, or in a contemplative moment, or in study, or also just in generally in life, right? You have a stick-to-itiveness. You don't wander from here to there, from there to there. You know the story of the fellow. I forget what context it comes in, but if you need a well, you don't want to dig 100-foot holes. You want to dig 100-foot hole. Well, hopefully you don't have to go down that far. But, you know, you want to have a focus and a stick-to-itiveness, and that's what this samadhanam is sometimes translated as. Sometimes it's thought to be minimized multitasking. Not having too many irons in the fire. From a contemplation perspective, how do you gain this samadhanam? This is where Yoga Sutra, this is where the Ashtanga Yoga comes in. It comes in other ways too, but there are very concrete practices, yama, niyama, ityadi, etc., that talk about how to gain this ability to keep your mind absorbed in a very quiet state. Let's go on. Mamukshutvam kim, mamukshutvam kim, moksha me bhuyat, moksha me bhuyat, iti itcha, iti puts things in quotes. So iti itcha means this is the desire. What is the desire? Moksha me bhuyat, bhuyat. From the Dhatu Bhu, may there be what? Mokshaha, freedom. For whom? For me, may. Mokshaha me bhuyat, may there be moksha for me. So we've talked about this quite a bit, especially when we've talked about the Purushartha Vichara, how this moktum itcha, this I want to be free, all my Purusharthas resolve into this desire for moksha. Like on a railway station or at an airport, you'll see the trains or the air flights coming in at the bottom of the display. And then gradually over time, it'll come up until at the very top of the display. You know, when your train is leaving in the next 5 minutes, it's going to be up there near the top. When your plane is leaving, it's going to be on the top of the departure board at the airport. And so Swamiji uses that as an example of saying, we have all these desires, moktum itcha, this mamukshutvam, this desire to have moksha, is not just one of those flights, one of those trains that's leaving, but it's at the very top of the leaderboard there, if I can call it a leaderboard. And it's a tibra itcha. It's a very strong desire. It's the predominant desire. It's a desire to be free from the sense of smallness. It's born of viveka and vairagya, and over time, it actually grows. And this is what I refer to as dipta shiraha. I am a dipta shiraha. I'm one whose hair is on fire to that extent. Finishing up this section, etat, etat, Sadhana chatushtayam, sadhana chatushtayam, tataha, tataha, tattva vivekasya, adhikarinaha, adhikarinaha, bhavanti, bhavanti. Etat, this, sadhana chatushtayam, this is the fourfold sadhana chatushtayam. These are the qualities for an adhikari. Tataha, thereafter, after gaining these, tattva vivekasya adhikarinaha bhavanti, they become, bhavanti, adhikarinaha, they become qualified people, qualified students for what? For tattva vivekaha, tattva vivekasya adhikarinaha bhavanti, they become adhikaris for the tattva vivekaha after gaining these qualities, having these qualities. To the degree you have these qualities, you become alive to the realities that this teaching reveals. This teaching reveals the realities. It reveals what is satyam, what is true, what is tucham, what is absolutely false, what is anartha, what is not true, what is mithya, what is only apparently true. And it delves into the realities of what? It delves into the realities of the jiva, of the individual. Is there an individual? If so, what's the nature of the individual? What's the swarupa of the individual? Is there a world? We seem to have a world here. What's the nature of this world? What's the relationship of the jiva, the individual, to this jagat, to this world? Is there a God? If there is a God, what's the reality of this God? What's the swarupa, the nature of this God? And if there's a God, what's the relationship between the jiva, the individual, and the Lord and God? And what's the relationship of the world with the Lord? Really, what's the relationship of the Lord and the world? What's the relationship of the Lord and the individual? And what's the relationship of the individual with the world? And what's the reality of each of these? You know, what is true? What is false? What is only apparently true? What is completely untrue? Right? Like a square circle. Do we live in a world of square circles? No. We'll see. But when you have this sadhana chatushtayam, these fourfold qualifications, that's what enables us, that's what really provides the opportunity for a teacher to reveal what he sees, thereby making what some see as an academic philosophy into a living vision. So next week, we will begin this very beautiful section here, which starts talking about really what the tattva vivekaha is. Let's take a moment. Om swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimahishah pro brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yanchobarahitah brahmanah santu nirbhayah om sarve bhavantu sukhinah sarve santu niramayah Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchit Dukkha Bhag Bhavet Asatoma Sadgamaya Tamasoma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritangamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om Om Tat Sat Sarvam Ishwarar Pranamastu. You are all unmuted. Welcome to the land of the speaking.
I think I have become speechless.
Yes. Because
the thoughts that have come out from you are so profound that I'm speechless.
That's nice of you to say. it's just my teacher's words.
I have a question.
Yes.
So what I had was that, you talk about dispassion, being thing.
But yes.
When I see you teaching to us, you can't teach in this way unless you have the passion for it.
Yes.
How do you sort of reconcile that?
Well, that's really why I just in passing use the term dispassion, because it's literally viraga means vigata raga, the raga which is gone.
Yes.
It's lack of passion. But it's much more accurately translated as objectivity. Because, yeah, you want to be, if your hair is on fire, you're pretty passionate about putting that fire out.
Right.
And you can live engaged in this world in a passionate way. I mean, with enthusiasm and with a love for what you do and whom you meet. The dispassion of viraga or vairagya is an objectivity regarding what experiences and objects and relationships can provide vis-a-vis my own purnatvam, my own fullness. So that's where the objectivity, we don't give undue value to things. We see money as money and it can provide certain opportunities, but it's not really, there's no real link between that and my happiness.
It's not what you live for.
Yes, it's not what you live for, yeah. But
it's what you appreciate, yeah, but you don't live for it.
Yeah, you don't give undue value to things, right? You know, when I was a kid, I gave my entire heart to that red helium balloon. And when I lost it, I lost my heart and I was so sad. But now that I'm an adult, I can let the helium balloon go off to the heavens and I may enjoy it. I may enjoy just watching it float off. So I've developed vairagya towards helium balloons. And yet I can still have them in my life. I don't hook my happiness to the presence of that helium balloon. And I enjoy it coming and I enjoy it going, because that's the nature of things. That's the nature of the jagat.
And being that objective could actually allow you to live a more enthusiastic, cheerful life on the whole.
Yeah, because you're not fearful. You're not afraid of losing. First of all, you don't spend all your time collecting things, and then you don't spend the rest of your time keeping the things. And then you're not fearful because things go, and you don't see them as the source of your happiness, so it's not a big deal if they go. I mean, that's why there's something so beautiful about renunciation. That's why there's something so beautiful about sannyasa, because it's somebody who's just let it all go. But you don't need to do that. You just have to have that objectivity to see and work with that. We don't pursue things with passion often unless we see our happiness tightly bound up with things. But it doesn't have to be that way. You can still be doing what your calling is, right? Some people are called to music. Some people are called to write. Jayaraman, very nice. I have to say, is a very nice story. We have an author in our midst here, Jayaraman. And you can still do that, and you can still do that passionately, but the passion is not sangha, right? Kamaha is born of sangha, born of that attachment. A passion doesn't have to be intertwined. An enthusiasm and that love for what it is you do, whether it's you're raising your child or you're educating school children or you're writing code. You know, you can have a passion for writing the most elegant code, hopefully without any bugs. And yet you can be dispassionate towards it because you realize you're going to make mistakes and you're going to miss that target once in a while.
You know, it reminds me of what Pooja Swamiji had mentioned that last April. I visited the Gurukulam. At the end of a talk, he mentioned you don't have to take sannyas, but know what it takes. Know what it takes to be a sannyasi.
Yeah, so all of these attributes, all this, these qualities, sadhana chatushtayam, are really the qualities of a sadhu. So a sannyasi is a sadhu who has taken vows of renunciation. And there's sadhana, which is spiritual disciplines, practices. There's sadhaka, one who does sadhana. There's sadhus, one who embodies those qualities of one who has done sadhana. There's a sadhya, the goal to be reached. And there's a sannyasi, he's the one who's taking formal vows of renunciation. But we as non-sannyasis can nourish and promote those sadhu-like qualities in us. I mean, my role is to be a sadhu in everything I approach, because all I do is sadhana, because all I want is moksha. I mean, that's kind of the heart of things. And in the end, even a sannyasi cannot give up all action. Sarva karma sannyasa, which is a kind of a technical term for moksha, for freedom, is sannyasa, is the renunciation of sarva karma, of all action. And Krishna talks about this. And no one can ever give up all action, right? You have to eat and breathe and walk down the street and pay your bills. And, you know, so even a sannyasi, he doesn't give up all actions. He just relatively gives up other pursuits because he doesn't have an interest in anything else. But in the end, freedom is realizing that moksha is sarva karma sannyasa, which is only through jnanam, which is only through knowledge, which is the appreciation that I, in the truth of who I am, and free from all actions. I am not a doer, I am not an enjoyer, and I'm not the recipient of any karma pala. I'm not subject to any limitations, and I'm not subject to any karma pala. So that sadhu bhavana, that attitude of being, you know, striving towards being a holy man, really, you know, striving to being fearless and being compassionate and nurturing these qualities that we've been talking about. That's how we become a sadhu, which leads to then that vision of myself as really being free from all actions. And that sannyasa is acknowledgement of the primacy of moksha as my goal in life. But it's not a necessity. They give examples of, say, Janaka and others who were said to be, you know, in the Shastra, which are said to be enlightened and, you know, to be householders. In fact, many of the teachers in the Upanishads are householders.
What is the role of a sannyasi in our world? Because, okay, you renounce everything, you go away. What is the contribution they make towards this world? You talked about a writer. Okay, a writer is driven to write and contributes in a certain way. A doctor does in a certain way. A computer scientist does in a certain way, writes the most elegant code, whatever. But what is the role of a sannyasi in this world?
Good question. Well, in a traditional Vedic society, it was everybody's end game, in a sense.
Yeah, 75, yes.
Yeah. So you're a brahmachari, you're a student, you're a grihastha, you're a householder, you're a vanaprastha, you're retired, you know, you're disengaged from worldly activities. And then at the end, it's one way to look at it is that it's in the end, you're a sannyasi. You become a monk in a traditional society. One way to look at it is that you come into the world by yourself and you leave the world by yourself. And you don't have to take sannyasa as an older person. You don't have to go through all those stages. Like Puja Swamiji, Adi Shankaracharya, you know, took sannyasa straight from being a brahmachari or from being a householder. And there's actually three types of sannyasa. So Shankaracharya sort of organized the monastic traditions in India. And he came up with the Dashanami order. So some sannyasis are their last name, if you will, their title is Saraswati. And that's my tradition. That's Swami Dayananda Saraswati. Some are Giri. Some are Puri. There's various names given to these different, and they each are associated with a different Shankaracharya mutt, the details of which elude me now. And there's three types of sannyasa. One is called apatta sannyasa. And that apatta sannyasa, and that is how Adi Shankaracharya actually took sannyasa. It's taken at a time of danger or at the time of death, because some people want to be a sannyasi when they go to the next life, when they pass on. So they take sannyasa at the end of their life. There's a certain freedom that comes with it. You know, you're ritually relinquished from all your responsibilities, and you say, you know, all this is renounced by me. I won't say the Sanskrit, because you say this three times in Sanskrit and you are a sannyasi.
Okay.
I asked Swamiji this. I said, well, how about apat sannyasa? You know, what do you actually say? If worse comes to worse, like Adi Shankaracharya was, you know, he was swimming in a river when he was a child, and he wanted sannyasa, and his mother wouldn't give him permission. And so he was in a river one day, and a crocodile came, which is said later to be an avatar, I forget exactly the details, and pulled him under and said, mother, mother, I'm being attacked, I'm going to drown, please give me sannyasa, apat sannyasa. He said, tatastu, so be it, so be it. And so he did that, and he said these words, and he became a sannyasi, and he came out of the water, and his mother says, oh, you're so lucky, I have you back. And he says, nuh-uh. I'm a sannyasi, I'm true to my vow. And he went on, you know, did amazing things. He supposedly only lived like 33 years. He wrote all these commentaries. He was a great scholar. He knew the Veda, and he traveled from the north to the south, and he's an amazing, amazing individual. So that's apat sannyasa, a time of, and you say these words. So when I asked in satsang one day, a couple of years ago, I actually asked what these words were. And Swamiji wouldn't say them. He just, he alluded to them, so you knew what they were if you knew some Sanskrit. But he said, you got to be careful, because, you know, you say yes. That, and you're a sannyasa. And then there's vividisha sannyasa. Vividisha is a, you notice the reduplication there, vividisha, mumukshu, jignyasu. There are certain words where the first syllable reduplicates, like jignyasu, that's a desire for knowledge. Mumukshu, that's the desire for moksha. Vividisha is a desire for knowledge. Desire for knowledge. So people take sannyasa as a spiritual aspirant, spiritual seeker, because there's nothing else that they want to do. And, you know, they have no other obligations or in a position to take sannyasa. And they become a monk, and this is what they do. And they, for their own sadhana, they teach, they study, they meditate. That's their responsibilities, to study and to teach. And in a traditional society where people have a value for this, you become, as Swamiji says, a non-competitor. You are not after any of the scarce resources in this world. And so the society, you live very simply, and you teach, and there's some value in there. And so, you know, people come and fill your begging bowl with some food, and you have very simple needs. Yeah, it's changed in the world. Now sannyasis have websites and cell phones and whatnot. And then there's vidvat sannyasa, the last one, which is vidvat, which means one who has knowledge. One who has knowledge might, all things being equal, given their prarabdha, given, you know, what the karma that needs to fructify in this life has in store for them,
right,
all things being equal, they gain knowledge and they just become sannyasis, because they see that there's no reason to pursue anything else. They just revel in the truth in themselves. And they may teach if they have a teaching capacity or not, but they take sannyasa out of a deep nishtha, out of a deep understanding of the way things are, of the truth of themselves. And they just want to revel in that. They just want to sit with that. So when someone takes sannyasa, it's usually the middle one, right? It's usually the one where they have a value for this. They have a value to become a monk. They have a value for this teaching. And they don't have other distractions, and they want just to sit with this teaching. So their contribution in this context is to teach and to study and to offer this vision to other people, so that they can at least see, to the degree that they're able to see, that they are less encumbered by the burdens of life than they see themselves to be at this time. and that they see that that chicken door in that barn is actually open, and they can crawl through anytime they want.
Okay, I got it. So the teaching is one of the perfections, in a way, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. So it's basically teaching and study. And then others do charitable works. I mean, Pooja Swamiji has this Aim for Seva, which is an extraordinary organization, which does one of its primary goals is to create the residential houses for students, because many of the disenfranchised groups in India and the sort of the isolated villages, they don't send their children to school because of transportation problems, because of food problems. And so they create these hostels for students so that they can get an education. And it's been very successful. It's been a beautiful thing. So, and there's other sannyasis who have charitable works too. So another role is for, to the degree they're able to do good in the world and help others, they do good and help channel other people's energy towards doing good to others as well.
Thank you.
All right, it's getting late. Thank you all for coming. And I hope to see you all here next week. We'll begin the new section of the text, Om Tat Sat.
Thank you very much.